My name is Mark Presidis, and I direct the creative writing program here at WVU. And let me just say, it's a great night to be a Mountaineer. It always is, isn't it?
Yes.
Let's go. I'm too cynical an audience. Yes, is Gino here? He's an English major, I understand. I want to say on behalf of the Department of English and our chair, Jim Harm, our associate chair, Tim Sweet, a person of great talent, Laura Brady, on behalf of my colleagues in creative writing, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Ethel Morgan Smith, Alyssa High, Marianne Salmon, Glenn Taylor. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Nice crowd. Thank you for being here. I will be introducing our first reader, and then Jim Harms will be introducing our second reader. When my family and I decided 3 years ago that we would spend my sabbatical semester in Argentina, we also decided we would rent out our house. But to whom? No problem, I told my wife. I'll just go talk to the people across the street. Maybe one of their friends would be interested. You mean the frat boys across the street, said my wife? The ones who treat beer cans as lawn ornaments? The ones who didn't shovel their walk a single time last winter? The ones whom the cops visit on a weekly basis? I see your point, I said. I'll handle it, she said. So she placed the following ad in the Dominion Post. Wanted, spring semester tenant for family home on South High Street in South Park. Applicant must have a law degree, preferably from an Ivy League university. Experience as a psychotherapist, a plus. Neighbors have issues. They're also loud and frequently drunk. Applicant must also have published at least a dozen books, preferably in the genres of poetry, fiction, and memoir, and must have taught at prestigious universities around the world, including Harvard. Finally, the applicant must like cats, particularly the two cats whose care he will assume during his residency on South High Street. Please apply in person. You really don't want to rent our place out, do you? I said to my wife the next morning, the paper spread in front of me. Why didn't you just say so? But before she could answer, the doorbell rang. A moment later, Michael Blumenthal was in our kitchen telling us the story of his life, which, yes, includes a degree from Cornell Law School, work as a psychotherapist in Budapest, more than a dozen books written, a tour de force as the director of creative writing at Harvard, and, most important to the two creatures at his feet, a soft spot for cats. True story. Mostly true. Michael certainly is the most accomplished tenant we've ever had, and no doubt would be even if he weren't the only tenant we've ever had. His most recent book, No Hurry, Poems 2000 to 2012, is merely the latest in his large and impressive catalog, which includes the novel Weinstock Among the Dying, the memoir All My Mothers and Fathers, and my favorite, the book of poem Lapse, winner of the Juniper Prize from the University of Massachusetts Press. Michael and I have more than cats in common. We're both devoted swimmers, though we prefer you not to time our 100 freestyles. Michael's writing is smart, sophisticated, wise, and sometimes laugh-out-loud funny. It's a pleasure to introduce you to my favorite tenant, Michael Blumenthal.
Mark, don't just allow me the security. What he didn't tell you is those cats shed like crazy. Anyway, I want to thank the joy addict, Tim Harms, and the water addict, Mark Presidis, and the English department for inviting me, and my wonderful colleagues at the College of Law, most of all Jim Elkins, without whom I wouldn't even be standing here. And it's a great pleasure to be here tonight, and I will. Despite the number of books I brought up here, that's just to make me feel secure. This won't be long. Traditionally, I've always begun my readings by reading a poem by another poet. But tonight, there are two of us, and we have limited time. So instead, I'm going to read you a poem, poem by someone else. But it's by me. One thing, I've had a lot of aspirations in my life, but among them, I have never wanted to be this creature called a poet's poet, you know. I always thought if I were a baker, I wouldn't want to be a baker's baker. Or if I were a plumber, I wouldn't want to be a plumber's plumber. I don't want to be a poet's poet. So I'm a little simple-minded, which will be reflected by this poem. Poem by someone else. This is not my poem, but a translation of a poem by a foreign poet, much admired in my country. It is a poem of simple language. Stone, body, blood, and flower, and of simple events, of being born and being certain to die, of making love to one woman in the name of all women, and of gathering each night the bits of dust that fall from us and pouring them back into the body so that the next day might begin again. This is not my poem, but a poem which, if I were a citizen of another country, I would write for you. And you would love it, I'm absolutely certain. So I have translated it from the Czech and the Hebrew and the Polish and the Italian of the poets I admire, so you can feel free to love it. Since it is not my poem, but only my brother's, who lives in another country. Okay. Move on. I wanted to read a poem from my good friend Stephen Dunn. And I wanted to read this particular poem because he never would have had to write this poem. Although I am still going to beat him at tennis one of these days. But I'm a would-be athlete. He's a real athlete. And some years ago, I grew up in the ghettos of Manhattan, and I'm the only person who ever grew up in the ghetto of Manhattan who doesn't know how to play basketball. And, you know, it was a sort of ethnic situation. The Jewish boys played stickball, the black guys played basketball, and the Hispanics played things with bottle caps. But anyway, many years ago, as Mark mentioned, I was teaching at an eminent institution called Harvard. And I decided that maybe it wasn't too late. And so I went to the women's gym, not the men's gym, because I was too ashamed to go to the men's gym. I went to the women's gym and I went to the checkout counter and I got myself a basketball. And I thought, nobody will see me. I'm going to see if I can do this. So this is called Trying to Learn Basketball at 37. Stephen was the real thing. Trying to learn basketball at 37. Too late in the middle of midlife, I stand at the foul line, feigning an ease that is not my ease, imagining the cool swish of rubber through the hoop as my ball arcs like a wounded bird toward the net and falls short time and time again. Beside me, a girl who in my prime would have been merely called applause, dribbles elegantly to her boyfriend's right and whops a jump shot with such perfect parabolic glee against the fiberglass and down through the rim that I am awed out of my own envy and pause to watch and watch again as she drives hard beneath the basket and lays one up, elegant as a swan. Her boyfriend, too, possesses the grace of the right time and patting her like a teammate on the ass, fakes to her left and glides on the clear ice only the body knows, past flailing arms, and I am on again, as the ball shakes like a pair of hips through the net and drops. Now I am reminded it was the love of beauty that brought me here, and I pause once more, all will where thoughtlessness should live, and dribble cool as koozie toward the net, setting the ball again to air, watching it rise with the grim intensity of a blind date as it bashes hopelessly against the rim and hunkers back. Poetry, I console myself, is a kind of basketball. I can do that. Speaking of I can do that, I'm also really, really happy
to be.
Do you know that I just went so blank? And I just forgot your name.
Oh, Bruce.
Bruce Bond. Alzheimer's strikes very young. With Bruce Bond, poet, I've admired for a long time. I'm, you know, some days you don't even know who you are. It's so rare that I get to see Mark Brasidas with his clothes on that I thought I'd do a little poem for him since he mentioned this book. This book, Lapse, was written a long time ago. It's in 32 sections, which at that time I thought was half a mile. It's actually 36, but and a prologue, which makes 33, and 33 has been always a symbolic age. You know, Jesus and St. Augustine, all kinds of people at 33 per men. So there was a certain symbolic sense of the book being divided into three sections of 11, body, mind, spirit, et cetera, et cetera. I'll just read you the prologue. The philosophers in the audience, of whom I know at least one, probably know who Aristippus was. Probably nobody else does, though. Aristippus lived around 460, something like that. He was born BC to 350. And was the founder of the Cyrenaic school of philosophy, which argued essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, that pleasure was the highest source of morality, not morality. And so I'll just read you the prologue to this. O patron Aristippus of the flesh, who thought of pleasure as the final source, who watched the soul contort, the body thrash, but held to his resolve without remorse. O sweet immoral bard, who didn't see the soul's lot cast with dull divinity, who didn't hesitate to praise, to name, encyclicals of lust and greed and shame. O sacred father of desire, who found duty good, but pleasure higher, might I, a moral Jew, be blessed to find the key to life here, half undressed? Might I call Moses fool who split the sea while Pharaoh lay with one or two or three? I pray, dear philosophe of ethics in the moment, that I might come to wisdom here alone and swim with tear-starved gusto as I glide from pleasure to pleasure, side to side. Well, while we're on the subject, I'm going to float around. Bruce, I'm so sorry. I'm really retarded.
That happens to me all the time. I've
been thinking about your old name. I can't remember your name. I have two good friends in town, both of whom Judd and I admire, and I asked them for some advice on what to read tonight. And they both very generously gave me a list of about 15 poems each. And of the 15 poems that each gave me, one was the same. So there are two interpretations of what that means, and I'll leave it to you to decide. But this is the only one that made both lists, so. Virtue. After weeks of a healthy diet, exercise, abstinence from all forms of sexual activity, he'd had more than enough of his own piety. The rare hamburger and onion rings tasted so good, as did the chocolate cheesecake. In the interest of restraint, he said no to the vanilla ice cream. And even the waitress, not his type in any meaningful sense of the word, seemed a morsel worth contemplating. After all, a person could stand only so much of self-improvement, he thought. It was spring, the dogwoods were blooming, the eastern redbuds thrusting a haze of purple into the air, every once darkened corner crying out its possibilities. And what harm could a little indulgence do on a night like this, after watching King Lear at the local theater, when madness, senility, senescence might be just hours away? When betrayal, even by one's own body, was the likely outcome of it all. So yes, next time he would have that scoop of vanilla ice cream. He would have another Grand Marnier.
Virtue could wait until morning to resurrect itself. Gloucester was going to die one way or another in the end, and honor, though speechless, needn't be so sanctimonious about itself. Tomorrow was a new tomorrow, he thought, lifting his fork once more towards his mouth, his hungry mouth, his ravenous mouth, that God-given mouth made for eating and swallowing and taking it all bloody in. And, well, maybe I'll leave this one. This is going to scare all the young women in the room away, at least for me. Towards Bruce, probably. But I'm wondering, as I'm going to read this, somebody sent me, there's a poet named Nin Andrews who is also a designer, and she has a blog, and she makes cartoons of poems, and she made a cartoon of this poem, and you see this guy there who's much younger than I am, more looks like Bruce, actually, and he says, let me count the ways I would have made love to thee once. And there's this rather voluptuous looking girl there, right? And, you know, as you get to be my age, you start to think of, you know, the last time, various things, you know, last time you're going to ski down the Black Slopes, the last time your second serve is going to really make it in, last time you're going to hit that jump shot. And you also think about this. The end of sex. It was destined to end someday. So why not bow out now gracefully, close enough to the top of your game to remember what it was like? It was, after all, a lot like life, good at times, better at others, often disappointing, on all too rare occasions, unforgettable. Pretty girls had set up on various parts of you. So what if they were pleasuring themselves elsewhere now? What lay ahead, after all, were failed performances enhanced by pharmaceuticals, polite handshakes after a straight-set defeat. Did you really need to go out in such operatic fashion? Like Nelson Rockefeller, who, the joke goes, came and went at the same time. Or Leonard Warren in El Forza del Destino. Why, you'd had your day off der Bühne, as the Germans say, a better one than most. And now, whether a stage door left or right you exited from, it hardly mattered. Birds had been in your hand once, and now, no pun intended, we're off somewhere in a bush. But what was wrong with that? Let be finale of seams, Stevens said, and why not? You'd already made your living will, no heroic measures of any kind. So girls, take your hands off the old boy's knees, it'll get you nowhere. Silence may be golden for the flesh as well. He's happy just to be here, singing a little song of his own, no regrets. So kiss him one last time, tenderly. And if there's no heavy breathing in its wake, so be it, and let it be, and let it have been, and let, if it must, that sometimes beautiful something never come again. I'm not there yet, don't worry. Oh! You never know. Oh, actually, I'm gonna read one.
You tell me, give me a little, you know, one of these, you know, when it's time to go, because I had a drink before, and that's more drinks than I've had in 3 years.
Last time I read here was just a couple of weeks before my book, Hand, came out. It's called, That Has a Wonderful Kind of Hand, and all the poems start with Anne. And sometimes continue with Anne. All these poems began with the title. The title sort of broke the poem. I know you hate the titles, but the titles wrote the poem. So I'll read you one. This also, you can see what stage of life I'm at by these poems. You know, we won't get into it, but this is called, it was written in Costa Rica, and it has one Spanish phrase in it, which is, te gusta bailar. Would you like to dance? It's called, and now you have come to the place in this life when you'd rather see a monkey than a girl. Whether to stay up past your usual bedtime and wait for Melissa, the gorgeous waitress at the Marisol,
or to rise early in search of the howler monkeys and the blue morpho butterflies? Ah, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to search out endangered species or to continue your usual preoccupations with a proliferating one is the issue this night that holds you, vacillating as ever, yet somehow more centered here in mid-age, where little Melissa wiggles her tush beneath the plate of quesadillas that's coming your way right this very minute, along with a picture of homemade sangria, and Billy the proprietor, slap happy with the money of gringos and gringitas, sends a knowing wink your way, and a little full of monkey business yourself, you ask Melissa, ¿te gusta bailar? And yes, she does like to dance, would probably even like to dance, and God knows what else, with you. But the gods of sleep and of early morning are the ones you worship now, not the gods of sex, not the lip-smacking, orgiastic saints of your younger years. And so you order a dessert of tres leches, leave Melissa a large tip, wink at yourself in the mirror on the way out, and the monkey wins. Okay, where are we? This is called, it was written at the Prague Writers' Center. Sometimes, in moments of desperation, I teach creative worship writing. No, just these. This one's good. This is called The Pigeon, and it's set in Prague. Where is it? Here somewhere. This is that moment you always dread where you can't find the road course. Okay. The Pigeon. Whoops, that's the past. The Pigeon. Perhaps it was as bored of false praise as I was, or of lazy language, or maybe it was merely hot and tired from the summer heat. For when I returned to my apartment, it was lying there on the doormat, eyes opened, wings slightly spread as if to say it had had enough of hot weather, the tourists, the humidity, the talking. And there seemed little I could do beyond pouring some water into a dish and placing it in front of the door. It wasn't a day for optimism or for high hopes about humanity, so I went for a nap, hiding myself in the age-old solace of sleep, far from bad literature and the spineless flattery concerning it. And when I woke some 2 hours later, went back to the door. My little dish of water was the color of tomato juice. The bird's small head extended, eyes closed over the edge. And I knew there was nothing more I could do but empty the syrupy liquid into the toilet bowl, fold a straw doormat over the stiffened body, and carry it downstairs. It landed in the garbage bin with a thud. Poor, dead, eloquent thing. And then there was silence, a profound silence, a deep, wise, beautiful silence, nothing less, and certainly nothing more. I brought Exhibit A. I brought something with me. I've just been to Germany at this Dabber book called the Frankfurt Book Fair, where there are more books and writers and agents and everything than you ever want to see in your life. And I brought with me a copy of Der Tagesspiegel. Der Tagesspiegel is a paper published in Berlin, and good people like you and me read the Tagesspiegel. It's kind of a nice, liberal, decent paper read by liberal, decent people. And when you grew up like I did, you know, a German Jewish child of Holocaust survivors, you will forever have a complicated attitude towards the Germans, whether you like it or not. I think, you know, we have a job for our souls to do before it goes on to the next soul. And my job is to come to terms with the Germans. So I wrote this this is a villanelle, you know, like, do not go general until that good night, rage against the dying of the light. And if there are any Germans in the audience, my apologies. You know, my parents were half that too. I always said, my parents were German Jews, I always said they got the worst of both. They're good, obviously. Anyway, the Grünewald is a beautiful part of Berlin where respectable Germans who read the Tagesspiegel go on for their Spaziergang on Sunday. And of course, one of the mysteries of the Germans and the Holocaust is how did these people who gave birth to Goethe and Schiller and Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and so on and so forth and Hegel, you know, how did they do this? The Germans. Punctual, decent, historically regal, their shoes all arranged, their closets in order. The Germans are reading the Tagesspiegel. One has a schnauzer, the other a beagle. They walk in the Grünewald, father and daughter, so punctual, decent, historically regal. The pit bulls are banned now, despised and illegal, their masters all outraged, accused of the slaughter, while placidly reading the Tagesspiegel. It still has its wings spread, that old German eagle, on statues and monuments where once there were borders, lofty and hovering, historically regal. Not spendthrift or miserly, not overly frugal, yet burdened by history, darkened by murder. The Germans are reading the Tagesspiegel, proud of their Schiller and proud of their Hegel, of Rilke proud too, and of Goethe still prouder, so punctual, decent, historically regal. And what are they reading? The Tagesspiegel. I've been a German friend, so. I think being anti-German is just as bad as being anti-anything else. I'll read two more poems or something like this. This is a poem really based on a poem by Louis Gluck called Here Are My Black Clothes. I love these kind of angry, erotic poems, you know. In her poem, she is giving back the black underwear that her lover bought her, and the poem ends with something like, as for me, I will not need them in my new life. You know, really nasty. So I was trying to be equally nasty. Here's your striped shirt. I think now it is better to undress no one than to undress you. Here's your striped shirt, the one I bought to hide your furrowed breasts when you came to bed. I like taking it off, I confess, mostly for your arms, which were ample and fleshy, and because the flesh, the feel of flesh against flesh, somehow, even with you, made me happy. I washed it when you weren't here and folded it neatly back into the drawer where it waited for you like an old slipper. I tried it on last night, just in case, but it's way too small. So I want you to have it back, and your toothbrush too. You looked like a prisoner in it anyway. All right,
two more points. No, I don't want to. There's nothing worse than overstaying your welcome, especially when there's a better part of the problem. This is called Genetics.
Genetics doesn't require any explanation. Genetics. From my birth mother, I took my melancholy disposition, and from my father, the ability to get through life with a bullet in one arm. From my adopted father, a certain way with women and the ability to sing Auf Wiedersehen, no matter what the occasion. From my adopted mother, dead by the time I was 10, lessons on tenderness and failed mourning. And from my blind grandmother, Johanna, the ability to see with my eyes closed and a strong preference for touch over appearance. With the help of my stepmother, the longest survivor of all, I mastered a difficult course in the damages the cold heart can sow, and a generous primer on stinginess. From each one, blood or water, nature or nurture, I have taken something. And now, passing on to my own son, God only knows what, I am grateful to all of them. And to my brother Amos, from whom I inherited a certain cheerfulness, and my sister Judy, from whom a tolerance for pain and early death. I'm even grateful to my cousin Heinz, the baker, to whom I owe my love of the early morning hours, and to his brother Edgar, from whom, or at least I hope, I will have received the capacity for a long and generous life, the need for a daily swim, and the ability to go long distances without drowning. And I'll finish with this poem, which is the title poem of this book, No Hurry. No hurry. Thank you all very much for coming. I really appreciate it. No hurry. This morning, waiting for the paint on the fence to dry, I realized there was no hurry. No hurry waiting for the bus to come. No hurry for the sun to set or the moon to rise. No hurry even to arrive at orgasm, your own or anyone else's. There was no hurry, certainly, for the protoplasm of decline to make its way homeward. No hurry on the divorce decree, no hurry for the new marriage, for the new marriage certificate to arrive. No hurry for the blossoms on the butterfly bush outside this window to bloom or the apples to fall. No hurry for the ant just now making its way across this room to get to the other side, though thousands of its little brethren are impatiently waiting. There was no hurry, I realized, for these very fingers to make their ways over the keys. No hurry for the brave little homunculus of the day to reach afternoon. No hurry for the wrinkles around my eyes to widen. No hurry for impotence, bladder problems, mutating cancer cells. No hurry, darling, for anything to become or not become of us. No hurry for the plane to depart. No hurry, no hurry, no hurry, no hurry. Since sooner or later, we will all arrive at breath's finish line. We will all be winners, and we will all be still. And everything we had always been hurrying toward will finally be ours. Thank you all very much.